Greetings, everybody, and welcome to another installment of Innovation Crush. It's me, Chris Denson. Yay! In case you guys are tuning in for the first time ever, this show covers all things innovation, ideas, cool people doing cool things. That's a pretty nice 5 o'clock shadow, by the way. I don't know. And it's not even 5 o'clock, so that's impressive.
So it's 5 o'clock somewhere.
That's true. It's a happy hour on your face. Dr. Tom Waller, say hello.
Hello. Lovely to see you. Thank you.
Thank you. This is actually the first time we're seeing each other's faces.
That's right.
We've heard, other than like digitally. Yes. So I guess for starters, why don't you give us a little bit of 101 on what a Dr. Tom Waller is?
A Dr. Tom Waller. I tend to not overuse the doctor part because it would be immoral of me to claim that I use my PhD on a daily basis anymore. But no, I am British, so apologies to anyone that can't quite understand me.
No, I automatically feel lesser than just by the nature of the accent.
But what am I? Depending on who I'm speaking to, I'll claim innovator, sports technologist, scientist. But generally, I'm just one of those people that happens to be a little dissatisfied with the world and have managed to get myself into some fun companies where they give me the opportunity to address that.
Yeah.
And so, historically for me, I am first and foremost, I suppose, an academic. I studied at a university in the UK called Loughborough University. Loughborough is actually now officially the best place in the world to study any kind of sport related degree.
According to Loughborough?
No. They're pretty good.
By the way, this is the best show in the world to tune into to hear really cool people talking about innovation. just so you guys know.
No, independently verified.
Nice.
But I studied design engineering as a first degree. So my obsession initially was to get into car design. I'm a guy, grew up in a pretty rural place, part of the UK. So my obsessions were cars and sports, not at all cliche. And so I found that I had a bit of a bent for the sort of the creative and technical side of life. And there originally thought, well, I don't know how to make a career out of that in sports. I'm probably not going to be the professional athlete that I aspire to be.
Did you play any sports? Were you athletic?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, I grew up in a really athletic family. Before, like as a youth, it was rugby. So I don't know whether all of your listeners will be fully aware of the sport of rugby.
Rugby shirts were a big fashion statement in the 90s.
They were, okay.
So close.
Okay. Well, yeah, but rugby's, it's kind of like what we would call American football or hockey, but without the pads. So it's for really tough people.
Nice jab.
Yeah.
No pads, no helmets.
It's an incredible sport where in the UK, rugby or football tend to be the sort of the dividing lines between a lot of, you know, young boys, particularly at that time. And it's changed dramatically over the years, but my dad left me with an interesting statement, which was football or soccer is a game for gentlemen played by thugs. Rugby is a game for thugs played by gentlemen. So I chose the latter.
Nice.
But that was one of the reasons I went to Loughborough, because Loughborough is really strong for engineering, for technology. They had a lot of ties with automotive companies, and I got to play sport at a really high level, which I promptly gave up as soon as I started. And there were a number of different factors on that, but really just the distraction of being in this incredible place and being able to seeing and doing all these incredible things. Studied design engineering, went to work for Ford for a year, decided that car industry kind of sucked, certainly for me.
Right.
I just didn't see the opportunity that I imagined as a someone that wanted to be a true creative in that space. These are big companies, you know. A lot of the smaller companies were very artisan. So there was a gap that didn't seem to exist for me.
Right.
And so I came back in a bit of a flap thinking, well, what am I going to do? Recognized that within our school, it was mechanical and manufacturing engineering school, there was a sports technology research group, which independently verified is the biggest the biggest collection of academics all dedicated to the academic study of sports technology.
Wow.
as a hybrid research focus. So this is, if you imagine the early days, this was predominantly looking at engineered products, bats, balls, rackets, clubs, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
Less about the human per se, but performance was the focus.
You know, yeah.
Can we make these products perform better? Huge projects with Callaway helped build the, not me, but the group helped build the Big Bertha golf club, mm-hmm. one of the best-selling golf clubs of all time.
I was a caddy at the time the Big Bertha golf club came out.
Yeah.
And everyone was like, oh, it was all the rage.
Shortly afterwards made illegal, which is always a sign of
I forgot about that.
Yeah, when we do a good job, that's usually what happens.
Yeah.
But yeah, so a number of projects like that for Dunlop, for Callaway, for a lot of major sporting goods brands. And so it appealed to me. And I got into that by connecting with the academics involved. And it just so happened there was this young academic just joined. Mm-hmm. He'd done his PhD in human performance and he was a biologist. Mm-hmm. He was attracted to the department because he got interested in technology. He launched a company from his PhD. Selling a technology, a performance technology to elite athletes. He was also a rugby player. So a bit of a bromance ensued. And we bonded over rugby and the idea that technology and performance didn't seem to have been properly addressed yet.
Right.
And
Sense that the human component.
The human component. Yeah, that holistic view of what performance really can be. You know, using the disciplines that we understood, you know, of the sciences of the human body, the sciences of the built environment and, you know, products and that kind of thing. And so he said, well, I've got enough money. I'm new. I've got enough money for one PhD. Do you want to do it? And my initial response was, well, no, PhDs are for losers. I want to get a job. And
and then you became a loser.
Well, then there was this, somewhat. but he said something that I will simply never forget. So his name's Mike Kane. He's a professor now. Mm. And he's done some incredible things at and around Loughborough. He said, what if what we could create could be so uniquely useful that the entire industry will be knocking down the door to work with us? And I'm like, I'm hooked. Okay, let's do that.
Did he know what that was?
No, I don't think so. I just think that he'd seen
goal this, was the bar. There was a bar
that we could create a whole side to the business of doing the research that the group was doing around human performance that we believed the world wanted. And I loved the idea of being uniquely useful. I'd always felt uniquely useful. I just didn't know how to apply it. And so he then went from being an academic, started an undergraduate program. So we started to attract younger talent, which was, you know, really exciting. He eventually became head of the research group. I was his right-hand man. We built a brand new institute, generated a ton of investment. We had up to 50 PhD students at one time, all dedicated to this. We spun out a company. The company had a couple of arms. We were on one side having a ton of ideas about what we could do to build products for the industry that we sold to the industry.
Right.
So we had a licensing revenue and we had so many companies, and this was the kicker. And this is what really kicked off certainly my career. We had so many companies coming to the university, wanting input from the university, but didn't want to get embroiled in the long-term, slow-moving aspects of what it is working with the university. So we said, well, why don't we use this vehicle, the company we've got, and build a consultancy arm. We got the university to buy in so we didn't have to pay them any overheads. And we got to a place where we could just churn through like real projects.
Had you worked at this point, or did you just go straight through your PhD? Like, did you, when you graduated, an undergraduate, did you go and work somewhere and then go back to school?
I did a year with Ford. So it would be like a formal. I mean, I feel like I've always worked. I'd started my own company. I was doing writing gigs off the side. Working for sports magazines.
Yeah.
So I'd always had things going on. This, I suppose, was the first job that represented what has become this since like the rest of my career so far.
Yeah. No, it makes me think about like the idea of like having that world experience before you create a company, right? Or in the sense of you have an influx of interest in what you're doing, and then that just becomes the thing. So it's kind of, I guess they kind of go hand in hand to some extent.
Perhaps, yeah. I mean, I think I lent more into the naivety, right. Which was, you know, I knew enough to be dangerous and not enough to hold me back.
Right.
And that's become a little bit of a mantra. Yeah. And I believed at the time, you know, if depending on what the consultancy was going to do, that would be what it would be, that I didn't need to go and work for big company because I could work for all big companies because I could assemble a crew of people, you know, a diverse group of talent, and we could just go project to project, just doing really cool stuff. Yeah. And feeling really fulfilled by the fact that we weren't contained or held back by the what we were increasingly becoming aware of, which was the dynamics and constraints of enterprise, of corporation.
Yeah, it's also like almost like a danger of being an expert, right? Like,
yeah, I mean, it was
in a sense.
It was cool. It was really cool to be an expert, but we didn't have the restraints of, well, we've got to commercialize this within a product environment and understand all of the conditions of then retailing or wholesaling or
right.
whatever that might be. But we learned a ton by osmosis because these companies increasingly were pulling us deeper and deeper into the work that they were doing. And as part of that, and this was what really made it the uniquely useful component, I got to work with the team on every single product category you can probably imagine, from the tips of your toes to the top of your head, you know, from protection equipment, from children to seniors, from Olympians to recreational athletes, with technologies that someone had invented in their garage and didn't know whether they would work, to major companies hitting a roadblock where knowledge was now, you know, or absence of knowledge was now a barrier to their progress.
Right.
And we figured we could help. And we would just do these rapid turnarounds, projects that would be a day to 2 weeks to 3 months. And the university liked it because at some point when we were having then these repeat consultations, you know, we would be attracting the company to say, how do we find out more? Well, you know, if you could invest in supporting, sponsoring a PhD, right. Maybe you should.
This little elbow nudge.
Yeah. So yeah. It was a win-win for everyone. And I got to the point where, I don't know, 9 out of 10 times, and I won't name names, but we were telling people that their stuff just didn't work. And it was super frustrating because we could see that if we were involved in the process earlier, we could take that more scientific, methodical right. approach, understand the problem better to create more likely a successful solution.
But when you do jump on a moving train in that instance, I mean, there are some iterative things you can do, you know.
Yeah, it was always
timing. Is the frustrating part that they weren't willing to make the pivots that would be necessary, or like where was the frustration?
There's generally a culture in creative companies of not invented here. So that they would rather they do the invention and then looking for a more of a rubber stamping exercise in people like us really helping them to build claims or to demonstrate right. that what they did was amazing. And, you know, I don't know how many
it's probably
times.
Probably more frustrating for them, though, because I think giving that sort of honest feedback, I think a lot of times when, you know, I was sort of birthed in the agency world. And the client's always right to an extent, right? Yeah. The minute you give them combative or argumentative, whatever, feedback, it can be deflating for them
No one wants to know. Yeah, it's the hardest thing to be a consultant and say, well, the thing that you paid for, we're giving you a no. And if you want us to get you to a yes, you're going to have to do more consultancy. It's a tricky yeah. tricky business model.
Exactly. But it's like taking your car in to get fixed and you're like, oh, you're going to need another car. Like, yeah, I don't even know what that part is.
Yeah.
But, okay, all right. I'm here now.
Yeah. 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 Once you're in, you're in. And it was, you know, we learned a ton about relationship management. We learned a ton about the different dynamics within the organizations we were working with. What is the role and influence of a designer? What is the role and influence of the business director, the raw materials groups that, you know, we could really see and understand the hierarchy at different stages of the development.
Yeah.
And a lot of these companies have their own research or R&D arms. And they, what we recognized that we were doing so differently was just the ability to transcend any discipline. So we worked hard on being everything from the deepest aspects of what it is to be a human at a psychological level at the time. Mm-hmm. And we've matured that a lot more now. All the way through to, you know, what is it to be in a precision engineering manufacturing environment where, you know, the very latest technologies are influencing how they can build products. So there was just no limits to our ability to help.
With that, you know, when did passion kick in, right? Because I think either whether it's passion for the sports technology arena or just in the craft as you're speaking of it now, because I think at some point a switch turns on, right? There's one thing when you're 19, 20, 23, like, oh, this is what I might do for the rest of my life. Then it's like, ah, yes, like something connects with you personally. Like, well, when did that happen?
Well, it was after taking a bit of a risk, which was, you know, we were sitting comfortably in the consultancy. I was doing some research work for the university on the side. And one of my clients, Speedo, said, hey, we're looking to...
I'm wearing some right now, by the way.
You are? Yeah, me too.
Yeah. Oh, cool.
They were looking to hire a new leader for their innovation R&D team. And the guy that was running at the time had come off the back of probably one of the most successful product launches in sporting history over the last, I give it 50 years, which is the product called the Laser Racer, which took the Olympic Games by storm in 2008. Mm-hmm. And the appeal of picking that up and taking it to the next level and having the responsibility, understanding why if 9 out of 10 times before I was telling people that their stuff didn't work, putting my neck on the line to be making sure that like the 9 out of 10 things we do worked.
Yeah.
And so the switch became getting the other side of that risk, you know, moving to the other side of the line, going away from, you know, being the agency,
it's a huge
being
stretch. The client,
and taking responsibility for a team. And, you know, I took a lot of risks associated with, I hadn't led a commercial R&D team before. I'd led a team that was really, you know, comfortably sitting in an academic facility and environment. And, What I realized in there was what leadership can look like. Mm. And I discovered my leadership. And it was actually going back to, you know, being captain of the rugby team. I just thought, okay, this is all I got to draw on. You know, we were a small band of, you know,
thugs.
Brothers and thugs, you know, in rugby. And the same in the consultancy. It was just a tiny team of people.
Yeah.
We didn't have the hierarchy or the complexity. And like, well, this is all I got, so I'm going to use it. And it really worked.
Mm-hmm.
I realized that a lot of people that had more of traditional background going into those environments just had a completely different way to navigate the business. And
well, something to be said about being scrappy, or, you know, so there's a line of thinking that says some of the best innovation comes from constraint. And
yep.
So when you do have a small team, or you don't have enough resources, or you don't, like, you are an academic institution and you don't have like travel budget, whatever the hurdles are, you figure out innovative ways to overcome those things.
Yeah. Well, and coming from a place where we'd had to every day obsess humans, I realized that it translated just as much to the team that I was leading. And so, you know, I got to an environment, there was a ton of brand success around this product. And the question was, well, how do we turn this into a commercial success? And what I walked into was classic that I'd seen in so many other companies, whereby innovation R&D team sitting on a bit of a pedestal, the rest of the business going, well, how are we going to turn this into something? And, you know, there was this void, this gap in between. And
right. It
was, you know, somewhat obvious to me. It's like, well, why do we think we're special? Why do we believe that, or why do we not recognize that these people are our customers? You know, we work for them, and if their business is not successful, then we don't have a budget.
Yeah.
And so I flipped the culture when I got there, and then I just thought that, well, you know, they had done an amazing job, and I thought, well, if I codify that, and if I bring some of the other knowledge that that I'd had from just experiencing this whole human approach, well, then maybe we can do a better job.
Yeah.
And so we really flipped the culture of how innovation and the R&D team was consumed within the company, which then in turn changed our ability to translate intellectual property to ease and smooth out the relationships, which then accelerated our ability to innovate, because if everyone wants to work together and all those diversity, you know, diverse backgrounds are sitting around a table now, talking together about what are we going to do, well, then it happens. And so I mean, in hindsight, it sounds like such common sense, but at the time it felt like, well, this is the way we
work. Oh, yeah, no, we're all creatures of habit. You know, like most companies, even they hire someone as talented as yourself, they don't know how to make the adjustments that they need to make. You talked just a second ago, you know, about this idea of building relationships,
yeah.
which wouldn't be on a job description, you know, like, oh, yeah. You have to build relationships and then do the thing, like the shiny objects. How did you go about navigating, you know, just the nuances of cultural change?
Well, it was primarily about recognizing the value and different kinds of diversity.
Right.
So what tends to happen is, you know, birds of a feather flock together, right? And that in the moment that it happens, you see a narrowing. You see a slowing down of true ideation from happening. So what I taught and what I represented was, you know, there's a difference between inherent, acquired, and collective diversity, and we need all of them. So, you know, I have a particular background that has value. And then there's part about what I represent is, you know, white male that makes me not particularly diverse. So I need to make sure that my inherent diversity gets better by acquiring more diversity, the new things that I can learn, the greater empathy that I can generate, and who I hire and who I partner with.
Right.
And then it's not about a relay race. I fundamentally disagree with any process in a business that talks about handover. You know, I come from team sport. That's really my heritage. Yeah. Doesn't matter who scores the goal. It matters that the goal gets scored. And, you know, you practice patterns of play, but it's not, okay, I've done my job. Now it's your turn. So we sit around a table, we close a circle. We make sure that the people around that table are both inherently are acquiring diversity, and as a collective, we are super diverse. It's a lot to debate through. It's a lot of different opinions and points of view to navigate. But communication and good communication, pre-built relationships can smooth over most of those.
And also, in that type of environment where it's not accounting and it's just where you can actually hand off, like I did this, you know, part of the, I did 1999.
They still have a role. I think the finance team still have a role.
No, I agree. But I think what I was getting at is that you also have to have groups that are willing to have tension with one another, right? Yeah. Like voice your opinion, and it's a safe space that we're all here for the greater good. I've been using this phrase a lot lately, which is as opposed to trusting the process, trust the goal. Because the process is going to be messy, and I may disagree with what you did yesterday, but I do trust that you have our best intentions in mind, and like keeping that in your head at a point of contention.
Yeah, and I don't know if you found something similar as well. I often get asked about the process.
Yeah.
And like, well, the process is whatever is required to get to the outcome for that particular outcome. And, you know, it's interesting, you know, reading a lot and meeting a lot of people. You know, we will always codify and maybe talk to a particular process that we may have used, but it's not a rinse and repeat.
Right.
Now, the number of projects that I've worked on is directly correlated to the number of processes that we've had to figure out. And getting people to outcome.
Oh yeah,
you know that the output, the outcome, the deliverable, the end state, you know, the vision that we can all close our eyes and imagine. Once everyone's on that, well, then we can all operate entrepreneurially in our own little bubbles.
It's so funny because I think a lot of times when it's an assignment or a CEO or whoever the asker is, we'll say we want to accomplish this goal, right? I just led a day-long brainstorm for a sizable organization, and they were like, tell us about the process. And I was like, I have 50 more questions before I even get there, because I have no, like, you know, it's not a rinse and repeat kind of thing. Like, I need to know who the personalities are in the room, you know, where they're coming from, like all these other inputs that I think sometimes can be annoying for the person who just wants to get to the thing.
Yeah. But that's good business is operationalized. And that is fundamentally counter to what they're asking people like us to do.
Yeah.
Which is to, you know, back up from the problem a little bit and maybe and perhaps offer or ask that we're doing it totally wrong. and if it's not totally wrong, well, at least there might be a better way.
Yeah.
And we're not going to do a better way by refining what we're doing. We're going to do a better way by saying, okay, what are the competencies in this space? What are the basic goals that we're trying to achieve? And are we still solving the right problem, or do we even understand the problem that we're solving? And that, I don't know how many times I've said that in my career, but it must be in the millions.
And what are we discovering along the way?
Yeah.
Like, you know, like always just having an eye out for insights. Mm-hmm. So fast forward a little bit. Mm-hmm. Speaking of white male and the space where white space was birthed.
They're not related.
That was such a weird segue, but I am the segue king. If there is the real Segway guy, the vehicle, mm-hmm. Segwayed off a mountain.
But the guy that bought Segway, not the guy that invented Segway.
Ah,
the guy that bought the Segway
company.
Been
telling that anecdote wrong for years.
Yeah. I mean, it's still the owner of Segway ended up, it's a little bit like Kodak, you know, they created the thing that killed them.
Yep. Speaking of which, see, another segue. Tell us about the white space at Lululemon. And I mean, you're basically bringing your expertise and methodology to this organization. You've been there for
7 years nearly. Yes. Yeah, exactly. 7 years this September. Lululemon, I had been a client. I'd consulted Lululemon back in 2007. And I remember getting on a plane, coming back to the UK saying, these guys are either not going to be here next year or they're going to change this industry forever. And the latter happened. And they had decided, you know, they were hitting a point in their trajectory where the rate of growth was something they really wanted to influence themselves. And they said, well, we recognize other companies like us have an innovation team. So they went scouting, they found me. And I recognized, and even the company I was at prior to that, there were cultural limits that didn't allow me to do everything the way that I really wanted to do it.
Right.
And Lululemon offered a really interesting flavor of culture that I'd just not seen anywhere ever before. And how I generally describe that in simplest terms is I've never seen anywhere with such a high tolerance for ambiguity. Like, this is a group of people that would throw the baby out with the bathwater if that's what it meant to serve their guests better and better and better. They were a retailer and vertical at that, which means they have complete autonomy about how they show up to the guest anywhere in the world, any way they like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they are primarily, you know, at that time, they weren't unknown in the UK. People thought I was insane. You know, a lot of my colleagues, they're just like, Lulu, who? but the people that knew they knew that this might be an interesting option.
Yeah.
And so when I was hired to head up product innovation, and I got there, I looked around the room, and you tapped the culture a bit, did a bit of mining, thought, if I call my job innovation, I am gonna get lynched. This is an innovation company. Innovation is the fifth word that comes out of every person's mouth. I can't stand here and claim it that I'm the one that's going to do this for you. Nor if I do that, then it's like, well, now we don't have to do it anymore. And now it's someone else's job. So the other language that I was hearing more and more, you know, more and more in the industry, more and more in the sort of the community that I'm a part of, but in particular at the company was, there are these white spaces. You know, we're such a fast growing company. There are these adjacencies. Yeah, what are we going to do about them? And I said, I think that's what you need us to do. So I rebranded it to white space just to be literal about the fact we are here to discover and populate the white spaces that the brand should probably be occupying.
Right.
And sometimes a category that we're already in has plenty of white spaces. You know, it's stagnant, hasn't been thought through properly for decades or maybe multiples of decades or it's broken. But more importantly, there are categories that should exist. There are businesses that should exist. There are models of operating that should exist that could exist just by giving the right group of people the right kind of focus. I went into the business and said, okay, rule number one, projects own people. People don't own projects. You know, we are not a brand inside a brand. So we are a competency. So I'll hire people that don't exist here, scientists, engineers, technologists, people that understand human behavior, you know, better than, you know, we currently do, or maybe that anyone does at the moment in the world. A focus on engineering and technology that doesn't come from an apparel background. You know, we were then a bit of women's yoga apparel retailer. And actually, if you asked external people, that's how they would describe us. That's not how the company was founded.
Right.
You know, this was a leadership and development company that wanted to elevate the world. That was, you know, the simple term that was use and stuff. Well, then we are unconstrained. We can learn from yoga. Mm. We can lean into the fact that we've captured the imagination of, you know, females all around the world, certainly all around North America at the time. And that taught us a different way to lead. It taught us a different way to interact with our consumer, our guest, as we call them, a different way to build the models of retail, and ultimately a different way to build an innovation entity, which is, you know, absolutely human first. And mm-hmm. I use that term deliberately, not human centered or design thinking, because I believe that there's a depth below what you see as behavior. So if human centered design is all about understanding what humans do, I want to get down to the neurological, molecular, biological level of mm-hmm. why. So it's leaving no stone unturned as to what makes a human tick, what could make a human reach their potential.
Yeah.
And we'll build that. And the fact that projects own people means that we don't get precious.
Well, when you think about the human potential, yes, in the sports technology world, there is movement, there's the biology of it. But in a yoga practice, it's so, and just to say that you're rooted in yoga, not to say that that's all it is, but it's such an internal practice as well. So how does that play into some of the day-to-day things that you're thinking about, or just in how you operate as a leader?
Yeah, well, you notice that I use human potential, not human performance.
Right.
Human potential is much more linked to the practice of yoga. And yoga is a practice. You can't win yoga.
You haven't seen me do yoga.
Maybe, you know, if that's what keeps you going.
Annual yoga competition. I do look around the room when I'm doing yoga and I'm like, I'm more flexible than that guy.
Well, yeah, I mean, yoga is not about stretching. It's about reaching.
I know.
What yoga taught me in terms of, it's a fully expressed practice. You know, yoga is a way of living. Not something that you do in a studio with your body. You know, yoga as union as all eight tails encompasses everything from moral decisions that you do or do not make, all the way through to the practice of meditation that is an extension of that. And indeed, there's some description that the asanas, you know, the poses, the physical practice of yoga is in preparation for your ability to sit still for a really long time, which is, you know, where enlightenment is most likely to happen as you practice your meditation. And if I look at that and I look at the other signals in the world, let's take blue zones, for example, mm-hmm. another code for living a great life where people are living long, healthy, happy existences. And other sort of organized ways that people tend to be in a really positive heightened state.
Right.
And so what we have as a code of everyone practices yoga, I wanted to take away the DNA and then, you know, genetically modify it in such a way we say, here's a code for life. What's missing? And we internally will talk about a lifestyle metric that we call the sweat life, which is how you exist in the world with sweat, grow, and connect. These, mm-hmm. If we are able to offer services, product experiences where you can sweat, you can grow, and you can connect with the world, we believe that that is a means to achieving your own potential.
Do you find that stillness, in the sense that you stated it, is counterintuitive to culture today? Because we're always on.
Yeah.
Right.
the currency is a little screwed up right now.
Yeah.
You know, the currency of busyness, the currency of, you know, blow your brains out in a fitness environment is wrong. You know, there's one thing that I learned from elite sport is there's no such thing as overtraining, only under recovering.
Mm.
So if elite guys know that, then it's only fair that everyone should have access to that. And I am on a personal mission to shift the currency, because the currency should be about quality, not quantity.
Yeah.
And it's the quality of the workout that you do, the quality of the relationships that you have, the quality of the network that you invest in, the quality of the recovery that you do. And I mean, I don't know if you've talked to many people about sleep as an example, but you know, the days where there's some kind of pride associated with being able to exist on limited amounts of sleep, they are dead and gone, and they, they're never you know, sleeping is the highest performing enhancing thing you can do.
Well, not only that, like, it's so a couple things on that point. Alexis Ohanian was on the show a couple years ago, but recently he's been talking a lot about going against the grain of thinking that founders and entrepreneurs and entrepreneurs need to be doing 80, 90, 100 hour weeks. Yeah. And he's like, no, that's it's just unhealthy. You know, it's unhealthy thinking and it's unhealthy practice. Second is Moran Cerf, who's a neuroscientist, who you should probably know. He's a hacker turned neuroscientist. Mm-hmm. But he's done sleep studies. He's like, that's the number one cause of happiness. Not even like, mm-hmm. yes, recovery from a physical standpoint,
yeah.
but just your emotional state of being. It's the, like, above money, family, love, sex, yeah. like it's sleep.
Yeah. Well, and when I say recovery, I really mean restoration. I don't mean sure. physical recovery. I mean your opportunity to, you know, to take your mind and body, which are inseparable, to the next level comes from your entire daily practice, including your sleep, and, you know, where meditation comes in. And you're probably, most people are already meditating, they just don't really realize it. We just want to give them more access to that.
What does that mean? That they don't really, just daydream? Like, what does meditation look like?
There's a number of different practices. I mean, if you notice that there's anything that you arrive calm from, whether it's your drive to work, maybe not in LA, whether it's the reading of a newspaper or a book or listening to music or the time that you spend with your children, the time you spend with your partner, the time you spend in nature. There's like we are always already seeking yeah. out what it is to take those moments, and you know, there are enhancements to be had with by introducing more mindful pursuits to your existence. But we all have them. We all have them.
Right.
And yeah, we are we're really excited actually to remind people that that's true. And get them addicted to themselves. You know, we know, I mean, I've worked in so much high performance that knowledge is not the key to high performance. You know, it's the behavior that you adopt and understand and try and the risks that you take.
Yeah.
You know, we all know that we should eat a little less cake, but we still do it. So
shout out to the Pop-Tarts I ate last night at 11 o'clock.
But yeah, so getting into a space where we can help people, I mean, potential is realized when you manage all of the choices that you make in a day, and knowing and owning the choices that are going to give you a little step backwards, and then having greater and better access, easier access, non-mysterious access to the choices that are going to help you.
And even going back to your greater mission, right, of the changing the currency, you know, conversation and approach, I think a lot of us aren't aware of how all the inputs have an effect on us. Like, if I wake up in the morning and I check my social media or go right to email, yeah. or I immediately jump into two dozen things, even when I do get ready to make that choice, there's still remnants of those mm-hmm. bits and pieces that I've taken in that affect how I might make a decision at 1 o'clock versus 3 o'clock yeah. versus next week.
And that's mindfulness. Yeah. I mean, mindfulness, like the true definition of it is non-judgmental awareness. So to be able to improve your in the moment awareness, because the present moment is the only thing you have. If you can change your awareness, judge it differently or not at all, ideally, then those choices emerge in a completely different way.
Yeah.
And what we like to do, I mean, the reason I kind of like coming from an apparel place is, you know, I've been propagating this concept of the science of feel, because I think it's the most important things that humans have. Yeah. You know, we feel our way through the world. What we feel is what we believe. And feeling is a multi-sensory component. It's what you see, what you hear, what you taste, touch, sense, you know, from a full multi-sensory capacity. Think about clothing. You know, human beings do two things that no other species does. We make fire and we clothe ourselves. So you get into, why do we clothe ourselves? We clothe ourselves originally for protection, no doubt. And then increasingly for, you know, statement. But the third way that's not often talked about is we're attenuating this signal, this experience we have of all the environments that we go into. You know, we can feel our clothes, whether we realize or not that we can feel our clothes. When you got dressed today, you got dress into an outfit for a reason, for the things that you are going to do today. And those micro choices, you made micro choices, you just weren't necessarily aware of them.
Do you like Game of Thrones?
I love Game
of
Thrones.
Or do you like Deadpool?
Yeah. And Deadpool,
some
yeah.
good mashup shirt.
But if you go back to that moment and you think about the predictions that you were making and the sensory choices that you wanted to have, you were setting yourself up for either success or not. And if we want to get people into a place where that they can then make, you know, more complicated decisions. Everyone gets dressed every day. So everyone is already making that decisions. Flip your awareness of that, help you realize that you're creating sensory choice and that sensory choice gets you closer to your potential. Every other decision becomes a much more straightforward nudge after that.
Yeah. I have a weird connection with fashion. Not weird, but my mom taught fashion design for almost 30 years. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, from fabrics to having rehearsals in our house for her students to, you know, being in fashion shows myself, I was a swimmer. I have this picture. You've probably seen this, Eric, in my living room of me flexing in a Speedo. Yeah. I must've been like 13. Like it's kind of weird and almost borderline foul. But I've always kind of thought about fashion. I worked in the industry for a little bit, but it's also the one great democratized form of self-expression.
Yeah.
Right. Because if a car or a house or these big ticket items may not be readily accessible to me, there's even documentaries on the history of fashion in hip hop. And they mm-hmm. talk about like in the 50s and 60s, there was sales training videos on how to sell clothes to the Negro. And they didn't mean it in the offensive sense, but they were talking about like how in, you know, poor neighborhoods, your clothes are really all you have, you know, and, you know, to be able to look good and feel better and feel better than your environment is, or your surrounding environment was so key to selling in this particular part of town. So I'm just accentuating your point, in a different way, but I love that. That's
well, the phrase, I use a phrase similar. You got to look like you feel good and feel like you look good for whatever scenario you're about to get into. And that doesn't, that people will often sort of, drop back to the word comfort. I just want to be comfortable. It's like, well, there's a can of worms. Like comfort to me is like Pandora's box. You know, there's no singular, definition. You know, we are comfortable at some points when we're uncomfortable. You know, why would we need to create the uniform of, I don't know, a business suit, which I don't really wear very often, if ever. I wouldn't claim that as a comfortable outfit, right. But it creates a statement, and the sensory experience of wearing that suit makes me feel powerful. And so when we start to understand what does that actually mean, we challenge it. We challenge, well, can I still feel powerful another way? Or what is it about that sensory formula that makes me feel powerful?
Yeah.
It can't be just what I see in myself and others. There's something about the cut, the fit, the weight, the texture, the pressure that it applies to my body that gives me that expectation of the perception that I'm looking for, that gives me the sense of power.
Well, I think, I guess philosophically, it really ties back into where you first started talking about Lululemon and the operating system, is that being comfortable with ambiguity. And mm-hmm. I talk to my kids about this. I talk to teams I've managed about, like, be comfortable with the idea of being uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. Because that's how we live on a day-to-day basis, you know. You get in a car accident on the way to work and you're like, it just disrupts your whole day. Like, you're going to have moments of discomfort. And the more you let them get to you, the less you're able to, you know, just thrive, I guess.
Well, the actions that you take are critical. So I meet a lot of people that claim to be comfortable with ambiguity, but that doesn't mean that they do anything about it.
Right.
And I think the people that I've hired or had to let go, generally, they've come in being clear that they are comfortable with ambiguity, but it's, do you get into a state of paralysis, or do you see a white piece of paper and you just start to create?
Right.
And that's a much rarer talent than I had imagined, actually, because of how many people that I'd met that could demonstrate that they could cope with ambiguity. Mm-hmm. But I mean, resilience is great. You need resilience, but without creativity, it's nothing. It's just like being tough.
Yeah. Oh, trust me. I mean, it's just having very much a lack of a brief on an assignment. You're like, okay, I guess that's what we're doing. And you're like, you just, you start the thing. But I wanted to transition a little bit into a little bit more of the brass tacks, right? Sure. And I think sometimes in the ambiguity, you find, see, watch the segue. Sometimes in ambiguity, you discover pain points, right? And I was looking at, for example, the Nothing Bra that you guys created, right? And kind of walk us through that project. But what I like about it was that through all this human intuition and paying attention, you start to discover different pain points that you can solve for in inventive ways. So I'll preface it with that, but you tell the story of the Nothing Bra.
Yeah, I mean the like Nothing Bra is part of a continuum of an exploration we've been on now for we launched first in 2015, so we started the research 2013.
Oh, wow.
And the principles that we were following was all around the science of feel, that we could hear people talking about and behaving in certain ways that we didn't feel were being properly listened to. People will talk about, I really like this product. It feels really light. And then typically the brand, the company will say, okay, we need to make it weigh less. And the obsession that I have, that I've built into the code of the team, is they said they want to feel light. What does light feel like? And we will take that principle to every single problem that crosses our desks. And it started actually in pants, and the pants that we had, and it's the core of our business. And I'm very lucky, we had some problems in 2013 which opened the door to us going after what is our core business, which as an innovator is like the rarest treat ever.
Right.
And so we took this principle. I said, I want to take a neuromechanical approach, which is I want to understand the dialogue between brain and body. What is it that makes our pants so good? What is it that when people say, I love the feel of your pants, they're like nothing else I've ever put on my body. I heard terms like, oh, you guys make the bras for butts, or, there's this phenomena.
There was
this phenomena floating around the business called the Luon orgasm, which is Luon was this fabric. And it was the first time that someone experienced Luon on their bare skin and the noise that they would make that would come from the fit room. And I was like, there's something there. Like, yeah. What is it? And he's like, oh, well, it's our secret source. And I'm like, well, apparently your source is so secret that no one knows what the hell it is. So we reverse engineered it. And I said, this is it. This is the beginning where we will be able to go anything on the body. We started on the body. We're going to ask, what is it that people are searching for? We're going to listen to their language. And then we're going to look at the critical attributes that make that language true. So if they say, I love it, it feels really soft. We're not going to say, is it just the softness of the fabrics? What is it that they're experiencing? Is it texture associated with the temperature of their skin? Is it something to do with how we lift their muscle and change the and sculpt the shape of their soft tissue? Because it might be something else. If we get that number one attribute right, then we capture people in the moment because they put it on their body and they get validated with the language that they want to use. We just make sure that we don't hear it literally. We make sure that we understand what it is that makes a difference. And I mean, it goes back to the genesis of, going in the research group, which was around golf clubs. Mm-hmm. What is it that makes a golf club feel really good when you drive a tee shot? It's the sound of the ball coming off the face of the club. It's not the vibrations that go through your hand. So if you take what appears to be the literal route, you won't get to a new or the right answer. And with bras, we did a quick follow-up. And bras, again, the language is, I want to feel supported, and my God, I wish I could just feel comfortable. And there's a paradox there. And there's a compromise in every product that we'd ever seen or ever tested.
Right.
That people wanted to feel supported. The industry at large was saying, okay, to feel supported is to eliminate movement. And we said, again, they said feel supported. They didn't say that they wanted to wear a bridge on their body. This isn't just structural engineering to add stiffness. Where in any other machine or system in the world, where if you had movement that was somewhat a requirement, a human body is required to move. If you eliminate that movement, when would that ever feel good? If you eliminated the movement of the suspension of your car, would that feel good?
Right.
No, you'd lose all your fillings. So we took a basic approach to say, we need to understand what are the true critical attributes of feeling supported, and what is the one that's at the top, and we better get that right. And so we built a bra, and it was, again, a cross-functional project across all of the teams of the business. We just led the scientific research and then the sort of the connecting of the dots and then the validation of every product right. iteration that came out. And what we were searching for was how do we embrace movement in such a way that that movement is allowed to occur? Because if I don't experience movement there in the right way, then I start to get into a place where I'm uncomfortable.
Right.
And so this was originally, it was a high support bra, and high support bra, meaning we wanted someone to really be able to run, you know, really like go through high intensity movement patterns. And we wanted them to still feel comfortable without, as soon as they're done, wanting to rip the thing off their body mm-hmm. and like put on their comfortable bra. And so we figured out the gap, you know, this white space between high support bras and, you know, what we had a lot of, which were these sort of yoga soft bras, and people were wearing them for completely different environments. And we then engineered a product that sat right in the middle. It embraced the movement of a breast, and it helped us to, and it encapsulated the body in the right way. It transferred the forces of movement all around the different right parts of the body, so that you didn't feel one pinch point, one anchor point.
Mm.
You know, it's like soft support. It's like really good car suspension.
Yeah.
That proved that we were right.
To use your car design thing.
Yeah, I tend to use it. my go-to analogies are automotive and food.
Nice.
So yeah, I guess that's just something I've
evolved. I don't think we've heard a food one yet.
No, we haven't actually, have we? I'll pull one out in a minute. But yeah, so then, so that was problem solved number one. In the world of building pants prior, we'd built a palette of sensations. So we'd reconfigured the way that people bought pants. That was, you know, we recognized people wanted a yoga pant. They recognized people wanted a run pant, or, you know, all of the different product iterations we might have. But people were using run pants for yoga and yoga pants for run. And so they were telling us something. And so when we started to deep dive into it, we understood that some people in some days, and the same person can want different things different days, I want to feel a little bit more naked and free and at one with the world. I don't want to feel held in, locked down, covered mm-hmm. up. And that might be, I want to feel like that for yoga, or I might want to feel like that for run. It's down to you. Your personal preference is your personal preference. But what it showed to us was there was this really big space around truly allowing someone to feel covered and supported, but so very close to naked that they would feel really, truly free.
Mm.
And so we built a naked sensation group of pants that have, I mean, taken our world by storm. But it showed us that there was this space, there was this, let's call it naked sensation, that can glitch people. So consider.
No, you see, I'm being very quiet because I'm yeah. probably the most immature person you've spoken to this week.
And so, but the when we then started to apply our attention to female support and category of bra, we're like, we hear the same language.
Yeah.
We hear the same language, which is, I just want to, you know, I want to feel supported enough, but really, I want it to not be there. And so we said, I wonder if it's possible.
Does that language change? Because, you know, with men's products, like I wear a ton of Lululemon. What I want to feel, or is that even an utterance, right? When you're dealing with a different.
Yeah. Everyone so often uses their very own language, and we will, mm-hmm. we'll cluster that language and we'll name the cluster. So right. the cluster is called naked, but. Well, what you would describe, maybe you would say no distraction, or like, I just don't want to know it's there. You know, you need a bit more of a broader right. phraseology or something like that. But we know what you're saying.
Yeah.
And you might even say, I just like it when it feels really light.
Yeah.
You know, so you might be, and it ain't going to be a measure of its mass. It's going to be because you're searching for that. The end result is that you want to feel what we call more naked.
Well,
or better than naked.
Better. I don't think there's a such thing, but no, I think when you think about like the folks that you've tested your products with, or the folks that you get the feedback from, but you're also selling products by the millions, mm-hmm. right? How do you know that you've gotten the correct sample size of individual input and design and so on and so forth, so that I can feel like this was made just for me, even though 10,000 other people might say the same thing, and we're all different body types and climates and cultures and all that stuff.
Yeah, well, we know that for products on the body, that there's a setting of levers around you, how you move, how you experience texture, how you experience your environment, because you're exchanging heat and humidity with the environment all the time. We know that you are uniquely you, and you're still just a human being. So there's some basic bands that everyone exists in, and then there are preferences that we have to make possible. And so the difference for other organizations is, like, here's our yoga pant. We will say, here are the different sensations that you can achieve in a pant that you might want to do yoga in, or maybe you want to go for a run in it. So just by the very nature of building a more of a human first and matrixed approach, yeah, people can find what they like better. And the navigation is the challenging thing. So for bras, we've built a system now where we can identify the way you move, and everyone moves uniquely. Your gait is like your fingerprint.
Right.
And we can take your fingerprint, and then by understanding a little bit about your psychology, a little bit about your emotional response to questions we might ask, a little bit about your behavior, we start to understand also your preference in terms of how you would like to feel. We don't overly go
like
after
sleep
that
number or anything.
No, not yet. I mean, there are ways to do stuff like that, but I don't want to turn any individual into thinking that a bra is a science project, you know. That I want them to just say the words that they would say, and then I want us to help them navigate the products that we have available so that they can more likely find the one that they like. So we call it your signature movement, which involves a very, very simple set of sensors that you don't have to own. We just, you know, help you out with them. An algorithm that takes you, that is activated on the basis of taking in a lot of, you know, qualitative information, mm-hmm, from you, that we've either watched you do or that you've talked to us about. And then we can help you get into the right product for you. And we'll always present you with choice. So there'll be at least three items that we say, this is most likely to fulfill your needs of the support that your body requires. Because, you know, you pick six different 32D breasts, for example, they will all move completely differently. And the owner of those breasts will all experience the sensation of that movement completely differently. So we have to make sure that you get into the thing that's right for you. And that we've cracked that. And that's taking multi-million dollar facilities that you can do it in to something that you can do for a few bucks in a store environment, maybe even in your home. And that's coming, you know, in the next,
that's great,
next period.
How did a couple more questions before we wind down, but how did the idea of athleisure change the approach to the business? And I don't know if you were there at the time when, like, it rose, but, you know, like somebody going to work and somebody like that's neither running nor, you know, yoga, but it's a fashion statement. It's still comfortable. Like, how did that change the approach to some of the things that you're talking about now?
I'd say it's the other way around. I'd say athleisure rose because of the business we created. So we preceded athleisure. And I would dare to say that we were the originator.
Yeah.
You know, we were the ones that recognized that people, particularly women, were living increasingly busy, increasingly transient, crossover lives. You know, they were, you know, professional business people. They were, you know, leaders of their family or members of their family. They, you know, they cared about their health. They care about, you know, their career, and so they were squishing more and more things together. And anyone that was going to help them to dress appropriately, to be able to simplify those decisions. So for us, it was a functional challenge. Let's help people look like they feel good and feel like they look good in all different kinds of scenarios without having to get changed into 20 different outfits in a day. So we did it because we solved the problem. It inspired a nation because people recognized that it helped them live their lives better. And I think that in turn, because it then became more apparent that more people were choosing to wear those things in the office on a date, you know, of course, to their studio, or, you know, out while they're exercising, I think that the fashion industry picked up their version of it and then, you know, took it to scale.
Yeah, no, that's great. It's funny, even as we were talking before we started recording about your chief product officer, who does a week in Vancouver and a week in Los Angeles, also is a mom of a young child. So mm-hmm. like she's almost in a, and I find this, I've come across a lot of people inside the organization. In some way, they live and breathe on a personal level what the brand represents. And I don't think you find that at a lot of, like, nobody at Coke is like, having a sugary dinner. Like, it's, you know, no offense to Coke. But I think there's something about the culture of the individuals that, you know, they're not just making the products and selling them. They're also, they understand the lifestyle from a personal level.
Yeah, you don't... Lululemon, you choose Lululemon as much as Lululemon chooses you. It's a culture that if you are someone that really genuinely cares about your health, your career, you know, they're kind of paradoxical sometimes, but we live on the assumption that if we plan, if we set our own personal visions and we set clear goals, that we can live big lives.
Yeah.
And if everyone's doing that around you, you realize it's possible. And there's a support network associated with that. There's a recognition of the compromises that sometimes you have to make. If family calls, you've got to be able to support them. You know, if work is heating up, then you're with the right kind of family that understands that. And you know, it is a cultural, cultural kind of. I keep thinking of disease, but it's because it's this airborne glitter that once it starts to stick to you, you realize that you can live a whole human life. And because the company is founded on that, we're not just trying to bring it in so that, you know, we fulfill some kind of HR quota. The company was built on living big lives as whole humans, recognizing that our responsibility is to elevate the world to greatness. And if we don't do that to ourselves, then we ain't got no hope with the rest of the world.
No, kudos to you and everyone, obviously, I think, for maintaining that. We've all seen a lot of companies grow and lose the thing that made them what they were in the first place.
Hell yeah.
So thank you for that. Where do you look outside, because I mean, you've been sports tech for a very long time,
yeah,
right? And there's a
human performance,
yes. But there's so many other things out there. I find like a lot of innovators have very meandering paths sometimes, like, mm-hmm. Oh, I've worked in, you know, talent management, and then I went and did this, and then I did, and so they draw from all those vast experiences. But you seem pretty astute on the holistic human experience. Where do you go for your own personal inspiration or information or updates or?
I read a ton. I'm a learn it all for sure.
I've got a book for you.
Yeah.
Could recommend.
I never turn down an offer for a conversation from the most out there source. I kissed a lot of frogs, but on the basis that every now and again you strike gold. You meet someone that totally changes the way that you think. They introduce you to a group of people that are able to solve problems the way that you've never been able to solve them, or they operate their business in a way that, you know, you haven't tried yet.
Yep.
You know, whether that is automotive, the food industry, sporting goods. I mean, wherever there is a human trying to perform better or trying to get humans to perform better, there's probably a lesson to be learned. And so yeah. I define my own purpose as being a crucible for knowledge and wisdom to inspire audacious acts. So in no way do I talk about sport. I am here on this planet for as long as they'll give me to help people tap into their own individual potential. And what I can do is go to disparate sources and connect the dots between information, knowledge sources to help generate wisdom, to generate more of my own wisdom, so that I can encourage people to go and do bold things.
How do you stay glued to that purpose? Because I think as much as a company can grow and lose that nucleus of, you know, what their brand is built on, I think the same thing can happen with people, right? You achieve a certain level of success, or, you know, your attention is taken by the doing versus being aware of, like you said, there's a bigger mission at stake. How do you stay glued to that on a daily basis?
I think for the people that are lucky enough to discover their purpose, it's not about being glued to it. It's about everything else just goes away. So if there are decisions that I have to make, it's only in fulfillment of my purpose.
Got it.
So I think that there are a lot of people that have not yet found like what it is that they love, what it is that they're good at, what it is that the world needs, and what it is that they can make a career out of. You know, answer all those four questions, you got your purpose. And if you've got your purpose understood in such a way that you know where you're at, that, you know, it is a practice, a bit of a mountain without a top. You it's not so much that you have to work to stay glued to it. It's just that you have to make sure that you don't allow anything to get in the way of it.
The show is called Innovation Crush. What have you seen in the world that you have a personal crush on? You just mentioned a lot of spaces you've walked into and conversations you've had and things you've seen and probably eaten. What is out there that you personally crush on?
What do I crush on? I am somewhat enamored by any individual who seems a little bit crazy to start with and is told no 1,000 times. And often they're a little obvious, the ones that I'll talk to, whether it's a Steve Jobs or an Elon Musk or a, I think the one that I go to that I wish I could have met would be Leonardo da Vinci. I don't know if you've read any of the biographies around him, but the concept of what it is to be a polymath, which you know, often he's talked about as a genius. I don't think he's necessarily a genius. I just because of the people that have written about him, they've said he wasn't necessarily a genius. He was the most curious person potentially that the world has ever seen.
Wow.
And he was deeply obsessed by not letting that go, you know, looking at his notebooks associated with, you know, I need to go and meet that sculptor to teach me how to sculpt. I need to go and meet that physician to teach me how to dissect a human body. I need to go and meet that you know, businessman to teach me how to, you know, figure out, you know, the mathematics of that time.
Yeah.
And there's just that really inspires me. I see a lot of great athletes just again not leaving stones unturned to find the greatest levels of performance. And, you know, it's come from their study of creativity. It's come from their study of the other things that help them to achieve greatness. And, you know, I'm really over physical performance. You know,
yeah.
we are not limited by our physical selves. It's all our psychological, perceptual, you know, emotional selves.
But you also do a lot of adventure racing. Yeah.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I do triathlon mainly now, so up to the Ironman distance, which,
yeah,
that's part of, I mean, when I think about innovation, it's a team sport and it's a contact sport. So it's kind of like rugby. It's also an endurance sport. And the most important thing that I learned from endurance racing, which, you know, my main non-family, non-work focus now, is that you don't win by being best at running or cycling or swimming. You win or succeed or achieve your greatest potential with pacing and nutrition. Like, good innovation knows how to manage timing, and you got to feed it. And so I bring those two principles all the way through my life. And, you know, I get inspired by great coaches, by great athletes, by great creatives. Anyone that is so curious that's willing to step out of their box into someone else's, you know, to eliminate then the boundaries between those boxes. But yeah, the obvious ones are the obvious ones. And my personal mission, you know, what the legacy I want to leave behind is that it is possible to do it in the most humane, humanistic way, whereby success is not attributed to any one individual. Success is always, you know, the sum of all of its parts or greater than, because you acknowledge there's multiple parts. I think, you know, leaders like us have to hold the space for it and, you know, take the heat for it. And, you know, I kind of, in a sick way, enjoy that part of it. And I don't know whether that's just by practice or what.
You know, I think there's, not to keep you too long, but I think there's something about the craziness of it that you have to love, you know, and in a lot of obvious ways, like I represent an underrepresented group of people in rooms that I go in. And sometimes when I talk to other Black or, you know, just inclusionary groups of individuals, so I was like, part of you has to just love that game of conversion, right? And if I were a white male who had it all and I'm an innovator, I'm still like, the game is still to convert you to my process, my methodology, my idea, whatever it is. You know, there has to be an excitement in playing that part of the game. I believe.
Totally. I mean, I seek out the adversity that I need that keeps me energized, given that, you know, I haven't had to face a ton of adversity. So I think it's more of an attitude and a mindset, which is, you know, I am dissatisfied with this world.
Yeah.
And I've got whatever's ticking down on the clock till when I have to stop. That's how long I've got to screw with it. And I'm not screwing with it just to make a point. I genuinely believe that we are so far from reaching our fullest potential. And if I can even move the needle 0.25%, then well.
Yeah.
That was.
Last but not least, complete this phrase for me. Innovation to me is,
can I answer it a few ways?
You can answer it how many. This is yes. You are a multi-potentialite.
If I get all, I'm going to be academic about it. Innovation to me is the recognition of barriers, the invention around them, and the resulting behavior that has never happened before, then being the norm. So that's what I'm looking for.
That's not well rehearsed.
Oh, yeah. I get asked.
That was not off the dome. That was not a freestyle.
I get asked the question in that way a lot. You know, if I'm teaching or writing about innovation, that's typically what I'm searching for. And I've read a lot of definitions and they haven't quite hit it for me, because so many things get called innovation and it makes the word dead to me.
Yep.
But for me, there has to be an obstacle and you have to invent around it. And that invention then has to change your behavior. Otherwise it doesn't matter. Otherwise it's just novelty or just the act of creativity that, you know, it has to be, you know, if art is what one person can do and science is the sort of the codification of that so that it can be done at scale, yeah. Innovation sits in there somewhere. I think the other side of that, like innovation, what innovation is to me, where it's obviously pays the bills. but it also, I think the most important, that just generic way to think about innovation, assuming that not everyone has the privilege of getting to do it for a career, is just that it reminds us that we are an inventive species, that we together, like humans coming together with other humans, that the way that our social infrastructure works, we're super curious. And we're just desperate to go and pioneer something. Yeah. Whether it's let's climb that mountain, let's get onto that other planet, you know, let's see if we can win this particular sports game. Let's try that food that's growing over there that we've never tried before. You know, the innovation to me is curiosity and the desire that the other side of that curiosity, something cool happens.
Yeah,
and that should drive all of us. Because I mean, what's the opposite to that? It's stagnation or, you know, working in a machine and just being a cog. And then you suddenly clock out at the end of your life and you realize that, you know, the world didn't really change because of the time that you spent on it. Yeah. And that's just not an option.
There's a line of thinking around the idea that, you know, the endorphin of successfully, you know, the endorphins that get released when you successfully solve a problem, like are, you know, almost like the feeling naked, or it's just it's euphoric. I spent some time working for a company called Machinima, and we did a lot of studying around gamers and that's the whole like idea of like figuring this out, progressing, defeating, you know, you're constantly in this state of goal accomplished, yeah. And that's why there's such a rabid multi-billion dollar industry around that thing alone. But it's, I think it's very indicative of everything you've talked about today. Yeah. Which,
well,
is
that's,
like,
I mean, dopamine addiction at scale, it does concern me a little bit, because that also, that's like, so if, you know, from a game theory point of view, there are other hormones we should be like fueling our bodies with, because the danger with dopamine is it is highly addictive. And if you think about, and it becomes kinesthetic, in that you think about the scroll on your phone with your thumb, you start to directly relate the microdose of dopamine you get from getting a like with the scroll of your thumb, which means you do it more and more and more. And what do you get? You get the currency of busyness. You get the currency of people fighting for our attention and us wanting to give it to them. And I think if we can get into a place where we're much deeper, more deeply taking in, you know, great swathes of oxytocin, you know, we're starting to experience the analgesic response of a true endorphin, you know, and whereby, you know, you get that release from exercise that that then is, it's like a pain medication that's like comes through your body. Those things improve your empathy. Those things improve your ability to relate. Those things improve your ability to be aware of yourself. And there's something fascinating about a world that's addicted to reward versus a world that would be addicted to, you know, human connection.
Yeah, you just scienced everybody. Science shit out of y'all. So where can people go to find more information on you? White Space, Lululemon. Where do you want to send people?
To go and experience our stores is to experience Lululemon. We have an incredible group of educators that we call ourselves associates that just are our brand personified. Yeah. If you want to learn a little bit more about me, I'm an avid LinkedIn user. It's where I mine the world for interesting leads and places that I can go and play. And I'm really responsive on that platform. Look us up in Vancouver. You know, we have,
which is like the cleanest city in the world.
It's one of the most livable cities in the world. Yeah. It does not suck in Vancouver. but we don't have a ton of information out there about White Space.
Sure.
But you know, we've lots of us now have started to get on the circuit where we're improving access to our profile.
Yep.
The brand as well is telling our story more and more and more. But yeah, we want people to know that we exist. We are an open door innovation team. And our job is to not assume we've hired all the smartest people in the world. It's to make sure that the smartest people in the world know that we would love to work with them.
That's great. Well, thank you for joining us here at WeWork. We.co/crush for more information. And everyone, thank you for listening. Thank you. I'm going to call you doctor anyway.
No. Well, thank you. Thank
Dr.
you.
Dr. Dub. No, thank you so much. This is an amazing conversation. And everyone out there listening, we will talk to you next time.